We're surrounded by information, and it's easy to turn this information into stress within us and allow it to begin influencing how we feel, how we act, and how we experience life. Whether it's a work deadline, the subtext of an email, the news media, advertising, past experiences, or so-called cultural norms, sometimes we can feel overwhelmed. Sometimes we just want to yell, "Stop the world, I want to get off." But if there was an easier way of being, a way of feeling, being, and acting that wasn't dictated by the stories we attach to the information that we swim in, but instead was chosen by us, for us, in order to experience our days and our lives in the best way possible? And what if it all starts as simply as taking a breath? This is Conversations on Living, a podcast all about being well, doing well, and living well. I'm Chris Brock, and this week I'm joined by world-renowned meditator, breathwork expert, and mindful alchemist, Scott Schwenk. Scott believes that in order to choose our reality instead of having it chosen for us, and to show up effectively and with our full potential in that reality, we must interrupt the routines and habits that allow our attention to be drawn to those things which don't serve us. And instead, we must take ownership of who we are, how we feel, and the energy we embody the day with. And it all begins with the breath. You can find out about Scott at his website, which is scottschwenk.com, or on Instagram, where he's most active and his handle is thescottschwenk. And you can also check out his classes on Commune at onecommune.com. Commune, of course, was founded by Jeff Krasno, who has also been a guest on this podcast. And you can find all these links in the show notes. So wherever you get your podcast, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. And before we get into the conversation with Scott, just a quick word about Headliner. Headliner is the service that I use to create those audiograms with which I market this podcast. You've probably seen them on Instagram. They're audio clips with a visual and a waveform or captions, and they're one of the most powerful ways you can market your podcast. So if you host a podcast, definitely check out Headliner. They're at headliner.app. Also, a quick word about Plane. Plane is a meditation game, and it encourages you to use the power of mindfulness to nurture and grow a beautiful island retreat. It's a really interesting concept. So if you like the idea of getting into meditation and mindfulness and want to learn some beginner's techniques and that sort of thing, then head over to plane.co. That's playne.co, or just search for meditation game and it'll be one of the first results. And just a reminder to head over to Conversations on Living as well, and you'll find all the other episodes of this podcast there, and also stuff about my writing, my books, and my newsletter. And if you subscribe to that, you'll get a freebie to download as well. Now, time to get into that conversation with Scott. I'm really grateful to Scott for his time, and this is a wonderful conversation, and a reminder just to slow down and breathe. So I hope you enjoy this one as much as I did. Scott, it feels right now like the world is on fire, like both literally and kind of, metaphorically. We seem more divided than ever. Everyone feels tired. It's like we've got deadlines, we've got bills to pay. There's pressure on us to kind of lose weight, look good, perform well. And life is hard. And I think the way I'm going to start this is just by asking, like, help. Help. What can we do to keep showing up every day and to keep, bringing our best selves to the world when it feels like the world is kind of imploding, if you like?
Well, first, you're absolutely right from a particular perspective. From a particular perspective, the world is very, very hard. This morning, here in sunny blue sky Los Angeles, outside my windows with my first client session, I've been enamored with, although they've quieted down for the moment, these birds outside the window. And from what I can tell, life is not hard for them. And so if it's not hard for everybody, then I don't know that I can say that it is hard. What I can say that it's hard from particular perspectives. And then as I begin to sense that there are other available perspectives that I can try on, like trying on different outfits that I might not normally wear in a dressing room, try on some different perspectives. Like if I look from 80,000 light years or 80 million light years away from the Earth, and I really settle into the possibility of that perspective as much as I might, What do I see? What do I sense? And then if I look from the perspective of the sandy bed of the ocean floor, you know, I try on different perspectives. So I begin to see, as I try on different perspectives, if it really is working, I begin to actually be able to observe the perspective I was looking from, like an object I can then start to turn around and be curious about, rather than this is how it is. And that's the beginning of my freedom. And if I notice, if I pay attention to what's happening with my breathing as I'm going through that process, if I'm really exploring multiple perspectives in a way that opens me, my breath starts to deepen naturally. And I can reverse engineer that too. I can deepen my breath, and then I will have easier time accessing wider perspectives. So a lot of what we're discussing is perspective, and then within that perspective is attachment. Attachment to a particular experience or a particular outcome or a particular flavor of the moment that I wish to have or don't wish to be having. And that attachment is what creates hard or easy, depending on how attached or released from attachment I am. And that can be a very confronting thing to consider. Wait a minute, you're saying that my desire to have a certain income or to have a certain experience of moving about my city without needing a face covering or with a face covering is affecting my experience. Yes, absolutely it is. So then I can see, I hope, the degree of my attachment to an outcome, the degree of my attachment to my significant other showing up. We're coming up on Valentine's Day at this recording, showing up in a certain way around Valentine's Day, perhaps. And if they don't, then I'm upset. Now, would I have been upset if I was completely neutral about how they showed up? Probably not. So I begin to get a deeper look at how the way I'm looking is determining my experience. And along with that, affecting how I'm breathing. And how I'm breathing is how I'm living.
Wayne Dyer famously said, you know, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And I suppose there's
100%.
There's a little bit of that in there. But when you're...
How do we access that? We hear these memes, these powerful, beautiful memes. And wow, you know, he was somebody who really walked the talk, even as he was dying of cancer, especially as he was dying of cancer, right? But how do we unpack that for ourselves, as opposed to use that as something to shame ourselves for not living up to, which is what a lot of people can do. I have done reading, you know, powerful texts or the autobiographies of great awakened teachers. And I've used their perspective to shame myself for not being where they are.
I mean, I do this myself. I mean, I'm supposed to be this kind of, I talk about meditation a lot, mindfulness. But then when I, like I have been recently, kind of, you know, I've let the world get on top of me a little bit. And then yeah. I feel guilty for kind of not, you know, practicing what I'm preaching. But, you know, we still do have to turn up every day and pay the bills, you know, and it's great to be able to put time aside to have a practice or to be able to sit and, you know, observe the perspective from the bird's eye view or from the, you know, the far reaches of the universe. But when mm-hmm. you're there and you're at your desk and your boss needs that document by, you know, in the next 5 minutes, how do you control that experience and that perspective?
That's great. Let's use that. First of all, interesting that the word control comes up. So we want to release that energy, because control implies there's something to fear. That things aren't actually able to flow naturally in a positive, harmonious way if I don't control them, says the ego. And it really says that in so many variety of ways. You know, it's quite prolific in the ways it convinces us to keep looking from the controller's perspective, that's afraid of some bad future. But here we are at the desk. Boss needs something in a hurry, maybe didn't get enough rest the night before, maybe there was some argument in the house, didn't sleep well, and still the work needs to get done. Well, let me first check in with the body, because that's the first reality. And how am I breathing? Can I bring more breath in a supportive way, which will help me to think more clearly, be efficient at getting the report done, and then go have a coffee or a water or whatever? It's how I'm framing my perspective that's creating my experience. I can't expect myself to see a new perspective if my nervous system is overstimulated and I haven't done anything about that. So the first thing, for me at least, over lots of years of practice, and I see this with clients as well, is to deepen my breath and slow my exhales radically. So let's just, listeners, let's all just take 3 really deep breaths and just see for ourselves. So you're not just counting on my words to be true. Let's see from your own experience. So take a deep breath in if your nose is open through your nose, if not through your mouth. Hold the breath at the top. Now hold that breath and melt your shoulders away from your ears. And like you're opening fists with your imagination, radically soften the soles of your feet and the palms of your hands. And then slowly exhale, as slowly as you possibly can, down the centers of your legs, out the soles of your feet into the earth, really, really slowly, having the feeling you're exhaling tension as well as the energy of excessive thinking. And do that twice more. Inhale deeply. Hold the breath, melt the shoulders, soften the soles and palms radically, like it's easy, and slowly, 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 even slower this time, exhale down the centers of the legs, out the soles of the feet, into the earth, letting go of tension and thinking, making it up that it's easy. And then one more. You know, Chris, are you noticing any more space in your awareness?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really quite, I can't tell if it's just taking the pause or whether it's the breath itself or it's a combination of the two, but it's almost like you've interrupted what was happening before.
And that's a principle of alchemy. Right. So if I want to change the form of something, I need to interrupt its rhythm. Everything has a rhythm.
And take ownership, so, I guess.
Correct. And the same thing with, you know, our lives. Some of us have a rhythm of what we do at certain points of the day. And it may or may not be skillful, helpful, might be harmful, actually. You know, the alcoholic, the drug addict has a rhythm of using. And when they have hit some bottom beyond which they don't want to suffer anymore, they get some sort of help, we hope, that interrupts the rhythm and inserts a new rhythm, a new algorithm. Maybe that's going to AA meetings. Maybe that's going to one of the other now emergent ways of healing from addiction, other groups. Maybe it's a pattern that's not needing a 12-step situation or a recovery, 90-day recovery residential thing. Maybe it's something like, I'm eating sugar because it's quick and easy energy. And whenever I'm overstimulated, maybe I eat sugar because I learned that as a child. And I begin to, instead of have that cookie, drink a green juice or eat something with dark green in it, you know, healthy and organic, and I'm inserting a new rhythm.
What's slowly. What's really fascinating from my perspective about this is that we talk about meditation, we talk about mindfulness, and it all seems very, very spiritual. You know, it feels kind of very much kind of somewhere, oh my God, this person's going to talk about God in a minute, you know. But then we talk about, you know, how, and I've had conversations on the podcast before about how, you know, our spiritual self shows up in physical ways. You know, when we're stressed, it can show up as kind of maladies in the body, headaches, migraines, stomach ulcers, things like this. And what you're talking about here, it's very practical things. It's about interrupting those routines, those rhythms. And, you know, there's this connection, you know, in the personal development world, there's a lot of books about habits. You know, there's James Clear's Atomic Habits, things like this. And that's, again, is all about rhythms and that kind of thing, which is not, you wouldn't consider that spiritual. But it is, I guess our spirit is how we show up in the world, isn't it? It's the energy, you know, and I don't know if you have it in America, but we've got a phrase in the UK, when someone's in a good mood and they're doing good work, you kind of say, that's the spirit, you know, well done.
Right, right.
You know?
Yeah, well done.
Like, you know, it's like, we kind of half expect this to be kind of woo-woo stuff, and it's like, okay, get the yoga mats out. But actually, this is good, solid, practical advice?
If we look at what that actually is, we're talking about, you know, woo-woo spiritual stuff. Well, if we look at it on a practical level, somebody's sitting, standing, laying down, or in movement. Full stop. Directing the mind in a certain way. So same thing for cooking, same thing for having, you know, mind-blowing sex, or driving a car, sitting, standing, laying down, or in movement. Everything else is our story. And the story is the problem. The story is a perspective, and it's only a one perspective, you know?
Yeah.
I've shared this in other podcast interviews. You know, you're standing at, we're exploring a barn together. Let's say we're, you know, we're out in the country, out in Cornwall or something like this, and you're at the front of the barn, I'm at the back of the barn. Neither of us has been to this barn, and we're on the cell phone telling each other what the barn is based on our perspective. We're not going to agree unless we both have traveled around the barn and seen all the same sights of the barn from above, below, sides, front, back. But if we're, you're in the front, I'm in the back, we're likely to argue about what the barn is. We're climbing a mountain. The view from first base camp to second base camp is completely different. The view from the top, the summit. So to remind myself, and I do this regularly, if there's any agitation, irritation, I'm looking from a limited point of view. There are other perspectives that would give me more awareness and choice.
When the world is getting on top of us, like it can so easily do, I mean, we're surrounded by, bombarded by information, misinformation, news, scares, you know, the world.
But you're saying it right there.
Yeah.
This thing that I wanted to touch on. One, interesting that just the ordering of words, when the world gets on top of us,
yeah,
like the world has its own, like there's a thing called the world that has an agenda to suppress us. Meanwhile, what we call the world is an amalgamation of all these different minds and their perspectives. There's no is world as such. I'm getting under the world, but I don't see how I'm doing that. And one of the ways I might be doing that is the first thing in the morning, maybe I'm looking at the news feed on the phone, the actual news, so-called the bad news, really. And I'm letting that tell me how to feel that day. Well, that's no different than the codependent spouse who wakes up in the morning asking his wife how he's going to feel that day. Asking her, how am I going to feel today? No. I get to choose. And I get to choose with how I'm breathing, how much tension I'm either hosting or softening in my body, and the perspectives I entertain. So one of the principles might be to stop reading the news. Reduce what's coming in through the phone and the computer to the degree that I can and still do my work, my hired job or whatever it is. But like there's so much I take in that I don't need to take in. You know, there's brilliant content right now to watch at night or any time of the day on all these platforms, you know, Netflix, Hulu, blah, 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 HBO. And I like to be entertained by a good story. I went to acting school, went to conservatory for 4 years. And yet here I am, you know, at dinner time at my house. I've already worked out and I sit down to make the dinner and I eat the dinner. As I'm eating the dinner, I'm watching something and it takes me about 15, 20 minutes to eat or so. And then I want to clean up the plate. So I pause whatever I'm watching. Last couple of months, I don't turn it back on. I'd rather go into practices, sit in the bliss of mantra, or watch my breath, or meditate, or contemplate, enjoy the beauty behind my thinking mind, rather than consume more content. Yeah. So we have to be responsible for the degree to which we're wounding ourselves on the regular and pouring salt on the wound by continuing to reach for more noise because it's a habit, not because there's something wrong about it or we're bad people, but we've got this habit of reaching for stimulation because it's familiar. So to take the backward step, as they say in Zen, and rest, look for opportunities to rest, whether that's for 30 seconds, 30 minutes, 30 days to retreat. My first teacher, Swami Chitvilasananda, my first major teacher, she said once in a talk, the reason she observed people not healing from illness and whatnot, on the whole, not the only reason, but one of the main reasons, is they're not getting enough silence. Some of us have the opportunity to walk into the forest. You know, you're in the UK. Those who are in London can walk into Hampstead Heath and get some silence, or those in New York can walk into Central Park, or not everybody has a park nearby, but if you do, go. The birds aren't having a problem. They're just birding around.
It's powerful stuff, really. I mean, we're so, like you say, we're addicted to not just content, but having to do things all the time. It's almost like if we're not being productive in every given moment, either in our consumption of something or our action towards something, it's almost like we're not fulfilling our duties as a productive person.
Yeah, and that's just the perspective of this particular episteme we're in, this particular epoch of time we're in, is very much that way across the world in developed nations. Not everywhere. There are places where people still prioritize relationships with nature, with each other, with themselves, quiet, making art, making dance, making music, and really are quite happy. But on the whole, more and more so, so-called developed nations are on this hamster wheel leading where? We're all what? These bodies are going to die. Suzuki Roshi, who opened the Zen Center in the 60s in San Francisco, brilliant realized being, very, very beautiful. You always see his smile, even if it's just his eyes. You can tell it's real. He said, death is certain. The time is not. What is the most important thing? And are you attending to it? Death is certain. The time is not. What is the most important thing? And are you attending to it? Being busy, you know, and I've worked with people in ad agencies and things like this, doing culture work with them. It doesn't mean quit your job, but if I want to be efficient at my job, I have to get a relationship to the silence. A musician understands this. If there's not silence between the notes, there's just noise. So what's my relationship to stillness and silence, which is the source of my nutrition, which is the source of my rest, which is the source of my creativity, or not even mine, but creativity. So what to do about the addiction is to just try a new dance move for a while and be consistent and not have to necessarily be extreme about it. Like, I'm not going to watch anything at all. I'm not going to listen to anything. I'm not going to read anything. Well, for one or two people listening, maybe that's appropriate to be on a long-term retreat. But for most of us, it's too extreme. So what can I reduce in terms of the noise? And can I pay attention to how I'm feeling to let that help me adjust along the way? You know, for me, as an alchemist, I look at how I'm feeling is the most important thing. My inner feeling is what's attracting my life circumstances and definitely coloring my point of view about everything. So learning how to say no sometimes and make peace with staying in that night, even though everybody else might be out partying, go, you know what, I'm gonna rest. I'm gonna listen to that guided meditation, or I'm gonna do some breath work, or I'm gonna read or paint or draw or make Legos. And the proof is in the experience. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, we talked about connecting with the body, feeling how the body's feeling, how you're feeling. And you've talked about breath a lot. And yeah. Breath work is something I know very little about, but it seems to be, the more I hear about it, the more I see of it. It seems to be everywhere at the moment. And so tell me a little bit more about it. Is it literally just being conscious of your breath? Why is it such a kind of powerful thing for people at the moment?
Well, first of all, there's not a right or wrong way to see breath work, right? So the tradition that I come from in this life is a Hindu tantric tradition, an Indian Eastern view. And there's a Sanskrit word, pranayama. And it's often mistranslated as breath work. It's not breath work. It's actually the work of balancing, organizing, and directing and shaping energy, our essential energy. And breath is the most simple way to do that. So there's all these different breathing techniques, like well over 500 in the tradition, that each shape and direct energy in their own unique ways. But it's about balancing energy, not about the breath as such. So there's heating breaths, there's cooling breaths, there's integrating breaths. When we say breath work has become popular in the world, generally that's referring to open mouth rhythmic breathing set to evocative music. And there are a number of different styles of that right now, different rhythms that people find sexy because they're such a big experience usually, like having perhaps been on a psychedelic. It is a psychedelic experience. And yet there are other much simpler breaths like alternate nostril breathing, Nadi Shodhana, that might be more appropriate for somebody and bring them more peace and clarity and stillness than one profound, you know, experience where they're, you know, shaking and sweating and blowing snot and laughing their head off one time. But to do a little bit of Nadi Shodhana, alternate nostril breathing at morning and evening each day, I find myself a bit more present, having easier time going to sleep, waking up more rested, being more present in the conversation, remembering what I've read, things like this, yeah?
Well, how does that work from a kind of a physiological perspective? What is it about these kind of different techniques that
wake Nadi Shodhana, the alternate nostril breathing, we'll start with that one, for example. One nostril or the other is more active at different parts of the day. And it's very much related to where the sun is in the sky. And so as we're doing alternate nostril breathing, we're actually balancing the hemispheres of the brain. We're balancing and opening both nostrils. And now this is a little bit more the metaphysical aspect. It's said that when the sun and the moon are balanced, I think is how it's said in one of the writings, when the sun and the moon are balanced, the energy rises up the central channel. So it's referring to there. So there's this central channel, this central nerve. It's subtle. It's not physical. That runs out the top of the head and out the bottom of the pelvic floor. Excuse me. And the energy centers we call chakras are blooming from this central channel. On either side of this central channel are the two second most important channels, the Ida and the Pingala, the sun and the moon channels. So normal breathing, normal living, we're in one or the other. And if we're able to balance them, the energy begins to move through the central channel, which starts a purification process, releasing us from our conditioned ways of seeing and perceiving ourselves and all of life. And as that releasing is happening, we begin to have more experiences of the space between the thoughts. Oh, wow. I still exist when I'm not thinking. In fact, I feel more myself than ever in these moments between thoughts. And oh, wow, there's a tender contentment in this silence, a tender blissfulness. Let me keep going. So you asked the question about the science of the breathing. That's a bit of this, a little bit of the mechanical science, but more of the esoteric science of it.
It's fascinating because we're always kind of grasping for something, aren't we? We're grasping for something out there, you know, some new practice, some new thing, some new bit of exercise.
Even spiritual grasping.
Even spiritual
grasping at spiritual experiences. And that, from the Buddhist tantric perspective, grasping is our problem because it's tension.
Yeah, breathing.
So any form of grasping, the breath is the simplest way to just deal with that. You don't have to become a Catholic or become a Sufi or a Scientologist or a psychology fan. Change the rhythm and depth of your breath. When I notice grasping, I breathe into the body deeply with great care, and I let go on the exhales, and I stay with the process, and I slowly release the grasping. And if I stick with this as a lifestyle, I begin to find I have less and less interest in grasping, and I notice the subtleties of grasping, I let it go, and my life starts turning out better than my ego had ever tried to construct it or manage it or project manage it. that things are coming naturally as I release tension that are better than I think I could have ever dreamed of.
It is amazing. I mean, breathing is something that we're born with. It's a tool that we use every minute of every day, but we just normally take it for granted. But one thing I've noticed, and I've noticed it since I started meditating, and when you're a beginner meditator, it's always focus on your breath, you know, breathe in, breathe out, just focus on that. And I started to feel like when I breathed out, it felt like forgiveness. It felt like letting go. You know, it felt like just kind of this, almost like a divine release, if you like, that suddenly I wasn't tense anymore. There was nothing kind of holding on to me. I wasn't holding on to anything else. Just for that split second, as I felt the breath kind of leave my body, it was a kind of moment of just complete release, if you like. How can we bring more of that into our life? Is it just a matter of setting time aside every day? Is it something
yes,
we can do?
Yes, definitely setting time aside every day ensures that we'll do it. And the more we do it, the more I do it and have a positive experience, the more I want to do it, and the more I set aside more time. And then it starts to become integrated into my walking around moments when I'm not doing formal practice. But we have to start somewhere. So scheduling it first thing in the morning is a great idea. And so I set the tone for the day rather than let the day set the tone for me. I want to set the tone for the day. And my intention each day is to grow, to use everything that arises in my life to grow. Grow in what? Well, grow in my capacity to be love. You know, when I was sitting at my mother's bedside in hospice 2 years ago, I saw very clearly that two things were most important about life: breath, without which the body's a corpse, and love. Without love, what's the point? And when they're both available, when I see that they're both available, the depth of breath and love are both related and available without changing circumstances, then I get really interested in building my relationship to love and breath. And then lo and behold, you know, as the a la the Wayne Dyer quote, when I change the way I'm looking, the things I'm looking at seem to have changed. So scheduling time for some breathing practice, and that might be as simple as starting the day, alarm goes off, sit on the edge of the bed for a few minutes, and maybe just take 11 strong, deep breaths in through the nose, out through the mouth, without pause. 11 breaths. At the end of that, there's going to be kind of a buzzy feeling and a spaciousness of awareness. And in that spaciousness of awareness, I consider things that I can feel gratitude for. It might be, I like the feeling of the sheets underneath my legs on the bed. Might be the way the light is streaming in, simple things that I can actually use to trigger the feeling of gratefulness. And along with that gratefulness, as I learn to sink into it, I ramp up the willingness to grow, to use everything to grow that day. If I started every day like that, and I did that 90 days in a row, I'm going to see some changes in my life happening. And then I can look at perhaps deepening it into some more formal practices, but it can start really small and simple. Life is a series of small moments.
It's almost like taking control of your state. You know, when I wake up in the morning, I'm kind of bleary eyed, and all the anxiety starts to crop up again. It's like, oh God, what have I got to face today? You know, what are all my failings? What are all my insecurities? They're all starting to pop up. But I guess it's a kind of way of kind of saying, well, hang on a minute, let me just take ownership of how this day is going to progress from here. Take ownership of how I'm going to feel about today and how I'm going to turn up.
Yeah.
How did you get started in this? How did you kind of fall into this practice?
I popped out really interested in things that people couldn't see, feel, or hear for whatever the reason. Probably, you know, if we feel that we've lived in other lives, it's probably picking up where one has left off or something like this. You know, I was having experiences as a kid, hearing thoughts, feeling what people were feeling, just interested at a young age. And between my fiction reading and nonfiction question asking, one thing led to another, and was able to have a lot of different mentors and experiences. I've been simultaneously from a young age training in spiritual development as well as leadership development. in university, I mean, I started meditating in high school, quite frankly, junior high school. I had a mom who was a training and development executive and an executive coach. So she had me reading whatever she was reading, Dale Carnegie and this and that. She also turned me on to, gosh, I forgot this, a chakra meditation on a cassette tape from Shirley MacLaine that she was using for de-stressing. And I started having experiences listening to that. And then it was going to the New Age bookstore every weekend with my mom, you know, reading everything I could get my hands on, past life regression and meditation and breath and crystals and just learning, soaking up like a sponge. And in university, I sat every week at this other bookstore in a meditation group for 4 years, learned, you know, Reiki back then, and was already facilitating inner work starting in high school with kids there, taking them through past life regressions, and somehow it actually worked. Shortly after college, like the year that I graduated, I found myself in a meditation intensive at a Hindu tantric monastery that I ended up moving into. I spent the better part of three years in my 20s in these Siddha Yoga ashrams, training and developing, and moved out to LA. And everybody comes through LA, so I found some fantastic mentors. And I've just always had somebody that I'm mentoring with, to include, you know, years of therapy, developmental psychology learning, stage development, different styles of meditation, Vedic ritual, mantra, walked on fire 12 times. And I'm not particularly special, you know, as a person, I'm as ordinary as dirt. I still have to sometimes wake up, like you said, with the monster on my face and deal with it. What I can say, looking back through time, is there's just this unwillingness to suffer that keeps me looking for the way ahead and what my part is in the moment. And I'm a recovering overthinker. There's ways that that's served me because I remember most of what I've read and heard. But I really, really, my biggest leaps happened in learning to relax my body, thanks to my mentor, Sally Kempton, who's been looking after me for about 27 years and training me. This business of relaxing, to get into meditation, relaxing the body, and seeing that even advanced meditators would neglect relaxing the body significantly enough in each sit. The more I soften the body, you know, we talked about softening hands and feet. There's four more points that I include. I call it the 6 points of softening when I teach anything. And I'm practicing it all day long. So you soften each area like you're opening a fist with your mind. Soles of the feet. Do it now, listeners. So soften the soles of your feet, palms of your hands. The four corners of your eyes. Let those corners of the eyes melt like butter on a hot day. The region inside and around the ears. Let the tongue rest on the floor of the mouth and soften it from end to end, as well as all the muscles of the pelvic floor, groin region, PC, sphincter, soles, palms, eyes, ears, tongue, pelvic floor. Lo and behold, we're in a light meditative state. I didn't have to think my way in. I can soften my way in. And as I soften my way in, and then I have an easier time with long breaths, and even just something as you said, being mindful of breathing as a way to meditate, it all becomes so much easier when I soften and willingly let go of tension. So I've taught myself over years of falling down and getting back up. The first thing I need to do is soften tension and lengthen my breath before I consider anything in thought.
It feels paradoxical because you can imagine, you know, that, like you say, we're very much suffering averse. So we're kind of, you know, I'm sure people come to you who've never
practiced. Actually, that. I'm going to interrupt you. With great love, I'd say we're actually addicted to our suffering. We're not suffering averse. We say we're suffering averse, but if we look at what people actually do in their daily rhythms is continue to choose things that reify, that feed the suffering. There's a book that I only have heard just the first few pages of the introduction that's making the rounds now, called Existential Kink. Oh, yeah. And it's really about how we get off on our suffering without realizing it. We actually get titillated by suffering without realizing it. And so we keep our suffering and the ways we suffer in the unconscious or in the shadow. So the truth, if we start to tell the truth, is we look what we actually are doing, we're actually chasing suffering.
Do you think then, with that in mind, we're kind of, there's a stigma attached to being happy and to being free of suffering?
God, yes. And there's this beautiful phrase that I'm grateful to have heard a few weeks ago, toxic positivity.
Yeah.
You know, the law of attraction, which is actually not a singular law, it's a branding phrase for about 5 or 6 laws of alchemy: law of rhythm, vibration, polarity, neutralization, and correspondence. It actually is how things work, but it's being misused and weaponized to shame ourselves and others. Like, oh, you better not think that thought. You know, a couple weeks ago, I had 2 people I care about both die in 1 week of cancer. Grief needs to be felt. If it gets suppressed, it becomes anger and depression. Somebody says to me, and I have a good friend who actually tried this, he's like, well, why don't you pivot to a higher thought, when I said that they were actually on their way out? And I said, you know, so-and-so, I really appreciate that you care about me enough to want me to be happy. But one, there's nothing wrong. These people are actually dying, and loss is touching me. And I'm not adding to the loss with adding story, but I gotta feel it. There's nothing wrong about it. And this approach that he was taking is a form of toxic positivity. It's like a superstition that if what I'm thinking about isn't like rainbows and unicorns, I'm gonna attract, you know, some horrible circumstance. So this is where we start to become more mature about the work with support. Go, you know, I have to feel what's here arising in my body as discomfort in the chest or the belly as I consider the loss of these 2 friends, or my mother a couple years ago, or my father 6 months after my mother. I get to be with the sensations with compassion, the way I would hold a child, without adding story to it. And I can bring my softening in my breath and metabolize, digest my past, which frees me up to be spontaneous and creative to the moment as it's arising, rather than just be some kind of, I don't know, carbon copy over and over again of my past. Does that make sense, Chris?
It really does. And it reminded me right at the very beginning of our conversation, when we took those 3 big deep breaths in, and it reminded me of rain, which is a practice that I've heard. When you feel an uncomfortable emotion, the acronyms, people use different kind of acronyms for it, but it's, you recognize the emotion, you allow it, and you investigate it, and you nurture it. So
love that.
And it's I think it was Jack Kornfield, who was one of his teachings that I picked up on this, and I only thought of it because I remember one time I was raging about something internally. Someone had said something and I felt that it was a bit unfair or something like that. And I thought, I'm going to just go through this rain process. And by the time I got to N, the feeling had been interrupted. So I'd kind of allowed it to be. And in allowing it, it kind of almost took the pain off it. So I was still angry, but it wasn't this kind of harsh, uncomfortable experience I initially had. And I guess that's what it's not about making friends, I guess, with these difficult emotions, but it's just allowing them to be, you know, and to, you know, burn themselves out if need be.
One of the yogic teachings about thought and emotion is when a seeker or a practitioner is ready to start practicing this way, to remember what the thoughts and emotions are fundamentally made out of, which is consciousness, pure consciousness, the same consciousness that's making my voice, the sun in the sky, the birds singing in the trees. That very same energy has produced planets, galaxies, supernovas, anger, fear, and sadness. So when I can remember that no thought is a problem, no emotion is a problem, when I can sense what they're made out of, that releases my tension which lets the emotion become self-resolving. This is a more of an advanced practitioner understanding, but it is available, which is when we don't get in the way, emotions are self-resolving. When we can just be with them as energy, they're self-resolving. It's when we get into the stories that we actually kind of put them in a glass box in the museum of our heart to look at them every day as anger, stuck as anger or sadness or blame or shame or whatever. But to deal with them is just, oh, these are just pockets of fuel. These are pockets of pure energy that can become anything when it's no longer bound by tension.
I mean, we create stories all day long, you know, from the moment we get up to the moment we go to bed. We're, you know, we're, someone is talking to us and we're thinking, well, what do they really mean? You know, that someone is, an email comes, you know, and there's no possible way of telling how someone felt when they sent that email because it's an email. But we, you know, we're thinking, well, that sounds a bit angry, or that sounds a bit off. You know, all day long, we're creating stories. I mean, is there a place for stories? Or are they,
of course,
intrinsically in the way of true
Definitely
experience?
A place for stories. Stories exist on many levels. Stories like myths can actually hold transformational energies that when we revisit the myth and unpack it with right understanding, it gives us confidence and energy and access to grace for our own journey. Stories can point out things that we might not have otherwise noticed. The research that I came across about storytelling is that the listener can actually, in the their brain of the listener, the nervous system of the listener, can actually have some degree of the experience of the character being described in the story without having to go on the same physical adventure. So stories can be very powerful and valuable. And as the tantric saying goes, that by which we fall is that by which we rise. So we can either use language and stories to suffer and imprison each other, or we can use stories to liberate. And then there's other options along the way as well.
I suppose all of this is about taking ownership of the stories. It's,
you know, story am I telling?
Yeah.
What story am I telling? Like, just pause for a moment, everybody. Listen to yourself right now in the car or walking or wherever you are. How are you currently describing yourself to yourself? Like, how would you describe yourself to yourself? And then when you get a sense of what that is, notice how it feels to live in that description, and then ask, is that the ultimate truth on who or what I am? Is that all I can be? Is there something I might not know about me or have yet discovered about me that might be vaster than my story?
How do we, when, I mean, you've evolved into this your whole life. You've been interested in it, you've practiced it, you've kind of explored different ways of being, leadership, spirituality, chakras, meditation. You know, it's been a part of your life from a very early age. When someone comes to you and they say, Scott, I am stressed out and I need your help. I don't know anything about this, but I need you to kind of just plunge me in at the deep end. I mean, are there any kind of immediate steps that people?
I immediately start them with the physical body, just like we did. Yep. Teach them the 6 points of softening. If they already know something like the body scan, sweeping up and down the body, then have them work with that because they know it, and work with the breath. And I show them that breath, the slow, long exhale slows the mind stream down. And then they begin to have the experience, oh, I feel a little space. I feel a little more peaceful. And then from there, we can actually start to look at other things. But until that provisional capacity to relax at will has brought online, there's not really a lot to talk about. You know, we could talk about the story about their boss upsetting them, but they may be holding on to being right about their point of view and stay mad. But if we start with softening the body and deepening the breath, other perspectives, other possible valid perspectives are naturally more available. And then there's not that need to, you know, like a like a chihuahua with a bone, just like hold on so tightly to being right about the boss being a jerk.
Is that this kind of notion of just relaxing into it, you know, taking those deep breaths, letting go of everything, letting go of the grasping and the striving? Can that actually make us more effective when we have to turn up in the office, for example?
100%.
Yeah.
100%, because as I'm more relaxed, you know, think about driving down the road. Thinking about driving down the road in a busy city, you're leaving someplace. Let's say it's your house. You live in London, we'll say, or Los Angeles, and you're in a hurry. You're running late. It's very easy to miss a car on a side street that's deciding to come out without much notice because I'm so tense that I'm overly focused on getting to my destination and beating traffic. So let's shift gears. I've given myself enough time to arrive early, plenty early. And in that spaciousness, as I'm driving down, I'm more relaxed. So my non-physical senses and physical senses are available to notice little shifts in the environment before they even happen and adjust. Something tells me, and I do slow down before I reach that side street. And sure enough, somebody peels out really quickly. It's happened probably to many of us. It's happened to me many times. So then I get to the office, and if I'm in a spacious, more spacious place, then when I get asked, say I need to create some idea for some project we're all working on, well, I'm going to have an easier idea accessing creativity when I'm not tense. The more tense I am, the more I'm just going to be revisiting things I've already read, heard, or seen, or thought. Not much innovation in that space.
Is this what you mean when you talk a lot about grace? Is this what you mean about kind of living in a state of grace? Just kind of,
yeah. I'm beginning to run ashore with that word grace, because The more I use it, the more I go, wow, everything is grace or nothing is grace, you know, from a really wide perspective. But yeah, I think the way I've been using it is a way of talking about flow.
Yeah.
Beneficial flow, organic flow. And I also like to use it to express that there's an innate intelligence in every particle throughout the cosmos. All possible manifestations of energy, all possible flavors of experience exist in the moment. In any particle, you know, your home, your car, wherever you're listening right now, has got as much grace as the holiest temple that ever existed on the planet already. Now, what's our part in experiencing that? Well, slowing way down more, using the breath, slow breath, and softening the body to begin to perceive beyond words in my mind called thoughts that are always describing things in favor of some sort of direct experience of what's actually here, whether I can describe it or not. So grace is the innate intelligence. Grace is the power of creation itself, whether that's, you know, this plant on my right that you're not seeing, is a stalk, like a pretty wide stalk, tree stalk kind of situation. It had three plumes when it was first given to me. And I didn't know what I was doing with this particular plant. I did my best and they died. They fell off, they wilted off and died. And I was really bummed out. You know, my friend Wilfredo gave me this lovely plant. And here I am killing it. I think I have a green thumb, apparently not. But something tells me to just keep being with it and actually just honestly loving it the way I would love a pet or a person, generating loving presence to it, and just water it once a week. And one day I look over and there's this little green shoot away from the stalk coming up. And now there's this huge plume that's not coming out of the original stalk. To me, that's grace. That's an expression of one of many expressions of grace. That the energy didn't die, the form it had taken died. the energy found another way to express. That's grace. So maybe at work or in the relationship, one door closes. Well, where's the one that's opening? Where am I being pointed and am I willing to discover? Or am I so attached to my past that I need to keep repeating it, whether it's been unpleasant or not?
Yeah, that's wonderful. I recently tried to make a list of people I admire and look up to. And it was actually very difficult because a lot of celebrities, I kind of maybe like their films or I like their books or something like that, but there's something about them that I don't quite, I'm not comfortable with. But I kind of drew up a short list. And I looked at this short list and I thought the something that is in common about all of them is that they seem effortless in the work they do. They seem very at peace with who they are and they seem very graceful. And, you know, there are a couple of actors on there. There are a couple of, but they're not the kind of people who would turn up in the news kind of with some new scandal or something like that. And they're not the kind of people who might have outrageous political views about this, that, or the other. They just seem to be very comfortable, very at ease, and very kind of like you talk about flow and energy and that kind of thing. And that I find very appealing. And I also find this kind of notion of being in this state of grace very appealing as well. It makes, just makes everything seem so easy and natural and you know, and I've heard people talking about, you know, when you relax into things, things happen much easier, they get much better. Athletes talk about it. I've spoken with other people, spiritual counselors who talk about this as well.
The thing about that though is newer practitioners may misunderstand that as becoming passive, relaxing into things as becoming passive, and it's not passivity. It is actual presence, but it's presence without trying to force an outcome, without trying to push the river, as it were.
Yeah.
And that takes some discovery and some practice. And so making peace with being in discovery, not having everything already figured out, is part of that gracefulness, I believe, whether it's the actor, or the painter, or whoever.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And I guess the practice enables you to kind of call on that state of being in even the most kind of what might be difficult or challenging situations, you know, when there is a deadline looming or when there is, you know, I mean, if someone comes to you and says, Scott, you told me to breathe and it's not working for me. You know, if I was you, I'd be quite, oh, I'm really sorry about that. But if, you know, if you've got,
well, gotten those phone calls or emails and it's not that the breath isn't working, it's the other things that one is doing around the breathing that are inhibiting the breath from really opening one up.
But being able to deal with those situations, and I guess just the more you can relax, but not passively, enables you to deal with that situation, to deal with the potential conflict or whatever.
And if I want that available to me in my ordinary or random moments, I need to train for it on the regular. Otherwise I'm just going to keep having more of what I've already trained my brain and nervous system to do.
So Scott, thank you so much for this. It's been really wonderful, and actually I feel very relaxed now having spoken to you for the last hour or so. But if people want to find out more about you, your work, your courses, learn about how they can start to, you know, breathe better and invite some of this kind of grace into their life, where can they go to find out about that?
So two places that can make it really easy. One, my website, scottschwenk.com, S-C-H-W-E-N-K. There's a whole number of guided practices, simple ones, courses, a 25-hour training, and it's growing every month. And also Instagram, in terms of socials, is where I'm the most active. So it's the Scott Schwenk. By the time I got around to changing my handle from Soul Matrix to my name, somebody had already taken Scott Schwenk, so I became the Scott Schwenk.
Fantastic.
And then for those who are abroad or around the world, Commune is a platform I have a couple of courses on, a new one coming out in a month. And Unity platform in Germany and Brazil has licensed some of that same content. So I'm around.
Fantastic. I'm around. I'll put all those links as well in the show notes. So they'll be on the website for the podcast and wherever the podcast goes out as well. So Oh, well, so that's brilliant. All that remains then is really just to say thank you for your time and for your wisdom. I've really appreciated it today. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
A wonderful conversation with Scott there, just reminding us to breathe, to let go, and let those internal narratives dissolve if they don't serve us. As I mentioned, you can find out more about him and his work at scottschwenk.com. And if you want to hear more episodes, then don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get this podcast. And of course, check out our website at conversationsonliving.com, where you can find all past episodes, my writing, my newsletter. And if you sign up for that, you'll get a freebie to download as well. And if you want to carry on the conversation, head over to our Facebook group. Just search for Conversations on Living. Next week, I'm going to be chatting with Nikki Eberhardt about how we can realize audacious goals, tackle imposter syndrome, and change the world. And please, 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 I implore you, tune into that one, because Nikki is really, really inspiring. And I felt energized after I spoke to her. So it's definitely well worth a listen. So mark your calendars, subscribe, and keep your ears open for that one. And all that remains is for me to say, have a lovely day until the next time. Cheers.